Usefulness, happiness, and thankfulness. Being thankful is easy, being happy is a little harder, but being useful is the hardest thing of all. Or so it seems to me. In my life, the three are tied together in some way. One leads to the other, or two stand together, producing the last, or simply the third derives from the second, which derives from the first. I have never been exactly certain which stands where. Other problems I have solved by getting them down on paper. For instance, in a large ledger book, I have charts of time spent on projects and time expected to be spent on projects, graphs tabulating projects completed satisfactorily, needing improvement or failing, diagrams depicting the relationships between hours spent drawing, reading, painting, or writing, income from each book plotted carefully against its brothers, comparisons of outflow of cash on paper versus tubes of paint versus Chinese ink, and so forth. Perhaps my favorite tool is the X and Y axis. Let X equal my ability and Y my desire. Or once, even, I plotted the thematic movement of Wagner's Parsifal, where minus X equals the subconscious, plus X equals the conscious, minus Y equals faith, and plus Y equals reason. Dull work, but I have rarely enjoyed myself more. However, I have never managed to draw precisely the relationship of usefulness, happiness, and thankfulness. When I left college, I spent a year in a little town in the province of Hessen, Germany, working in a home for children who were physically disabled. I joined the home as a volunteer, becoming one of four charged with the care of 9 children, ranging in age from 12 to 17. Our group, Gruppe Steppenwolf, had rooms on one half of one floor of a 4-story dormitory. We co-workers were split into 2 pairs, alternating biweekly between the early and the late shift, the shifts overlapping in the afternoon. So you see that 2 workers were needed to get 9 teenage children up, breakfasted, and out the doors to school, and at the end of the day, dined, washed, to bed. This was not impossible as far as the physical care went, since only 2 children required complete help in dressing, rising, bathing, and so forth. When I arrived, of these 2, I was given the responsibility for Jörn. J-O-R-N, Jörn. My co-workers assured me that my job would not be difficult to learn, as Jörn would tell me precisely, and they winked as they repeated, precisely what to do. I saw Jörn on my first afternoon as he rolled down the wide tiled hallway in his electric wheelchair. He was a 14-year-old boy with dirty blonde hair, cut shaggily. He had clear blue eyes, an upturned nose, and a very sardonic mouth. In fact, he was much disliked by his dorm mates for being a frequent taunter, dealing out wicked barbs to younger and older children alike. He was very round. He had a round head and a round torso. Each joint of each finger was round, and the small folds at the back of his neck were round. His toes were roundest of all, probably the result of never having been walked upon. Jörn saw to it that he was kept very clean, and as a result, he smelled good. On my first morning rousing Jörn and his roommate Peter, I entered their room at 6:30. I gathered myself together and gently placed a hand on first Peter's, then Jörn's shoulders to wake them. Jörn groaned, and Peter slept on. Abruptly, Jörn called for his urine flask, which I stumblingly looked for in the half-light, then found. I stood expectantly beside his bed until Jörn said irritably, "Well, pull down my pants and stick it between my legs." "Okay," I said. Then, following much precise instruction, I removed his pajama pants, without dropping his legs, pulled on his underpants, carefully, by gently rolling him toward me onto his right side, his great belly lolling, then to his left side, then back to his right side, tugging up his underpants as each side became free. Next, I lifted him to a seated position without forgetting about his head, and pulled off his pajama top, then selecting the correct pullover and t-shirt from his dresser, I pulled them down over his round head, minding the ears. So the morning went, and all the while, after attentively receiving each instruction, I said, "Okay." At last, Jörn turned his blue eyes upon me and said through the slit of his mouth, "You are getting on my nerves with all of your okays." And I said, "Okay." I determined then that the word I would use as a substitute any time I felt the word okay bubbling up would be mucus. 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 Jörn tried it. It sounded like moikus. This was agreeable to Jörn. Indeed, when I explained to Jörn precisely what moi kus meant, we became friends. I spent a year with Jörn. I dressed him in the mornings. I bathed him. I learned to anticipate his melodiously trilled pinkeln, which indicated a dash for the urine flask. I will never forget the special sound of the automated flask washers. I was so proud to know how to use them. By the second week, I was lifting Jörn into and out of his electric wheelchair alone, Jörn in my arms like a great 75-pound jello. This was definitely against house rules and certainly dangerous to both of us, but we didn't care. We were too impatient to wait for the arrival of my coworker, too haughty to use the hydraulic lifter, and I never dropped him. In the afternoons, I sat with him and with Peter, helping with their homework, doing my best to explain the proper use of negative numbers, supplying the answer to the question, what is the past participle of to go, or indicating, as well as I could, the difference between a phylum and an order. Often, when Jörn was sitting on the toilet or tormenting some child in the opposite wing, I sat and wondered about him, gazing at the collection of posters on the wall above his bed, mostly of the rock band Kiss. An assortment of these arrived each month in his teen magazines, and when one was deemed worthy, with infinite care, we removed it from its center staples. Then, taking off my shoes, I climbed onto his bed and stuck it with pink wall gum to a critically chosen spot. One particular afternoon, sitting next to Jörn as he puzzled out some piece of homework, I realized that all my years of education had exactly prepared me to do this work, that at this moment in my life I was perfectly useful. And I could not help noticing that I was profoundly happy, probably as happy as I have ever been. A few years later, I was very unhappy. I had just gotten married, but this was not the reason. Lydie and I were on our way to Liberia in the Peace Corps, but a number of complications, including an imminent civil war, detoured us to St. Croix in the Caribbean. We began a job there which made us both very unhappy. In fact, we felt less than useless. Our job was a good job, a job of service, but a job also of extreme stress. To put it too briefly, we were responsible for 9 orphaned or foster children, aged 3 to 12, beautiful children, but children who had already endured more than we could endure. Thankfully, we were given some time off, seemingly scant, but in hours and minutes, a third of our time was our own. The work schedule followed a 3-week cycle like this. 3 days on, 2 days off. 3 days on, 2 days off. 4 days on, 1 day off, 4 days on, then 2 days off before beginning again. We learned a couple of years ago that the VISTA volunteers who now form the staff changed this schedule to 7 days on, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., then 7 days on, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. In other words, every day on for 12 hours, which they find much easier, which tells me that if that schedule is better than our old one, then my memory of grueling days must not be far wrong. A particularity of the old schedule was that the work shift began and ended at 2 p.m. with a briefing of the new workers. Thus, during the dreaded and so-called 4-1-4, the off-going workers had exactly from the end of the meeting sometime after 2 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon to 2 p.m. on the following Monday afternoon to do whatever was necessary to heal themselves from the past 4 days and prepare themselves for the next 4. But this leads me from my point. My point is I was unhappy, and Lydie was unhappy. In an effort to find an antidote, we turned to what had brought us together in the first place, painting. Now I can remember my father saying to us as we left for Detroit and then the plane south to the Caribbean, "I'm sure you'll find a lot to paint." And we did. As our turn on a Sunday afternoon came and we faced a scant 24 hours to ourselves, we asked ourselves, "Where to?" We answered, "Out, out. Open spaces are needed. Air, sun, breezes." So thinking, we climbed into one of the little cars kept for off our use and quite literally headed for the hills. One afternoon, we found ourselves in the beautiful Danish colonial town of Christiansted on the other side of the island. We parked the car on a steep side street of charming, if dilapidated, Victorian gingerbread houses, tilting telephone poles, and much populated by great numbers of frightened stray dogs. We gathered up our big watercolor blocks, pencils, and X-Acto blades and simply walked out of town, uphill. Soon the red tin or tile roofs lay wrinkled below us, the overall yellow of the house walls peeking out between them and beneath the green of the palms, themselves revealed by the glory of the scarlet, flamboyant trees in bloom. Should we stop here? No, a little further up. We wanted the island to ourselves. The air became clearer, the breeze stronger, and the whole of the town sat below us, cupped by the piercing blues of the Caribbean sky and sea. We sat down on rocks among acacia trees, cooled by that perfumed breeze of mangoes and rot, listening to and watching the life of the town and drawing. The hours passed. At last, backs and knees creaking, we gathered our things, walked down the cooling hill, and drove back to the west side of the island. There, from the brick steps of a tumble-down house, not far from the apartment where we stayed, we again watched the life of a town, this time the poor town of Frederiksted, lit up by the horizontal rays of the setting sun in yellows and greens to stop all speech. After the sun had plunged below the horizon, remarkably speedily the way it does in the tropics, we turned the lights on, and the various chameleons and cockroaches watched us as we painted late into the night, painting the scenes we had observed in the afternoon, painting not, however, in the colors of the Caribbean, but in emulation of their glory, we used the purples and oranges and greens of the fauves we loved so much, and for a time produced paintings remarkably alike. 21 years and 6 months have passed since we began painting pictures on St. Croix, and I sigh each time I think of that great joy we had. Painting was useless work, but strangely enough, for those 24 hours, we were incredibly happy. A year and a half later, I faced a decision. I perched on the proverbial horns of a dilemma. It was 4 in the morning. I sat in the family room of my in-laws' house in the town of the university where I was expected to attend the first day of orientation for that year's matriculating medical school students. You see my dilemma. Was I to seek usefulness by becoming a doctor, looking for the happiness that I know comes with usefulness? Or should I continue to paint, happy now, though useless, knowing that uselessness might one day end my happiness, going beyond uselessness to become selfishness, pointlessness, good-for-nothingness? As you know, I chose to paint. Let me talk about thankfulness. I was extremely thankful to open this letter, dated July 3, 1991. Dear Chris, thank you for Charlie Parker. I quite love it, but need to talk with you. Or should I say, I quite love it and want to talk to you. Please call me. Collect is okay. Thanks. Sincerely, Richard W. Jackson, editor. I remain ever thankful for Dick's wit and guidance, company and wisdom. Of course, I am thankful that Norton Juster and Michael DiCapua, our editor, together had the idea to invite me to illustrate Norton's wonderful text for the Hello Goodbye window. Their combined good humor, great experience, and will continue to delight me. Further, I thank everyone at Hyperion, you who are here and you who stayed in New York. Your expertise is everything this book needed. And I thank every editor I have worked with, every art director, every designer, in fact, everyone working in all the several houses I have published with. I thank everyone, 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 everyone. I thank you all. Thank you. But I say thank you a bit sheepishly. Why? Because I know that you do not really do the work you do for me, particularly. I know this. I am not dumb. If you are good at what you do, and I know you are, then you write, edit, and design books because it is what you like to do. You do it not for me, but for yourselves. I would feel equally foolish saying, thank you for eating that delicious oyster po'boy. Thank you for curling up with that Agatha Christie novel. Thank you for getting 10 hours of sleep. Or you to me, thank you for each day, 9 to 5, winter, spring, summer, and fall, 50 weeks of every year, day in and day out, painting hippos. It just doesn't sound right. No, I want to thank someone else. I have in mind one person I would like to thank, and I hope she does not mind if I invest in her all the thanks I would express to all of you. It was like this. You remember that lovely letter from Richard Jackson. Charlie Parker Played Bebop was published a year later. It received mixed reviews, some glowing, some damning. Nevertheless, I was invited to read my book at a neighborhood bookstore, now driven out of business by the Barnes & Noble, which opened a block away, prompting one friend to lament, "Now where will we go to be ridiculed and condescended to by the sales staff?" It was that kind of bookstore. Still, someone there read my book, found me, and invited me to do a story time. I had never done a story time. I was willing, however, so at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning in late fall, I wandered the 9 blocks to the store. My audience consisted of a 2- and 4-year-old brother and sister, and another girl, also about 4. My memory is a bit hazy, but certainly one of them toddled and mumbled, the other two spoke, and I remember leggings and a fair amount of stripes. I know the parents were not much in evidence, probably taking a breather in the self-help section. The toddler sat in my lap. There was one more person in the audience, a rather taller person, but she only comes into focus later, as my attention was fixed at that moment at about knee level. As I had only one book to my name, I brought others along to read, including The Little Fur Family. I brought Charlie Parker Played Bebop, of course, and its reading went very well. On the second time around, the children bopped when I told them to bop and boombod when I asked them to boomba. The four-year-olds wanted to know about the cat. The toddler toddled. So the morning went merrily. After the appropriate half-hour spell, the parents returned to gather their children, giving me a passing smile as they rooted in their baby bags for bagels. Someone approached me. An elegant woman in blue, silver-haired and bangled. She spoke quickly and with a bit of a pleasant twang which I could not quite place. She said to me, "I can't believe you're here." I smiled blankly. "Why not?" I said. She clarified. "I was in town last night to hear Wayne Shorter, or perhaps it was another jazz personage." She went on, "And I saw this book, and I couldn't believe my eyes. And then I look in the paper and I see you're going to be reading here. And I was going to go home last night, but I just had to stay over to see you this morning. I can't believe you're here." What could I say? Nothing. She said, "How did you write that book?" I still did not know what to say, but I know I said something, for we spoke several minutes, and then with a rustle of coats and scarves and well wishes, she left me. I gazed after her. I knew that she mentioned she used to live in the city, now lived on Long Island, shared a place on 90th Street, my own street, and came in for concerts. I believed her husband was a pilot. I think she worked with books. I guessed she was into bookstores, libraries, schools, and lots of jazz. But I did not catch her name. Her name is Karen Breen. Now, I mention this story not because it might be amusing, but because it is essential. I know now from my many sources that Karen spent the next few weeks describing my book, reading my book, presenting my book to whomever she could make stand still for it, regardless of age or desire. She pushed, she shoved, she cajoled on behalf of that book. I've heard many times of her remarkable persuasion at that year's Notables meeting. I know that if Karen had not spoken then, there, I would not be speaking here, now. I have no doubt that one little thing has led to another thing and another thing until it is a big thing. I am sure it happens this way all the time. One person has an enthusiasm for one book, thereby creating success or failure. You may say, "Well, someone else could have come along and discovered that book." Yes, perhaps, but that is not what happened. What happened was that Karen Breen liked my first book, gave it a start in the world of librarians, the most important world for children's books, and made my career. I know Karen is not the only person to do this. Of course not. You all have, or you all will, for my books, and for many others. So I thank all of you. And I thank all of you with a special thanks to all of the members of the Caldecott Committee. So now, finally, I must finish this discussion. It is inconclusive, as it is only anecdotal. Still, I can say that over the years, my happiness levels for painting have remained steadily high. My usefulness levels go up and down, but now with this award are at a peak. I assert, and I hope it is clear, that my thankfulness to all of you is off the charts. I know I am happy. You are telling me I'm useful, and for that I am very, very thankful. Thank you.